Testing, testing.
Yeah, as things look now, we will not be able to finish our reading of Beyond Good and Evil next time. But instead of the free for all which I had envisaged for the 7th of June, we will have to study chapter 9. And I don't know what is preferable, but we have to bow to the dictates of fate. Now, we read last time the larger part of chapter 8, but we have still to discuss at least two passages in chapter 8. And may I remind you of the context. We saw that from chapter 5 to the end of the work, the subject is somehow, quote, nature, unquote. Chapter 5 was entitled The Natural History of Morality. And that the discussion led up to the call for the complementary man in whom the rest of existence is justified, aphorism 207. And that is supposedly the philosopher of the future. In order to make clear what the philosopher of the future is, Nietzsche contrasts him in chapter 6 with a class of beings who may be mistaken for philosophers, the scholars or scientists. So it's called We Scholars. Chapter 7, entitled Our Virtues, deals with the virtues not of the philosopher, and still less of the philosopher of the future, but with the virtues of the free mind, who, as we know, is only the precursor of the philosophers of the future and does not belong to that class himself. Now, his great virtue, of the free mind, is the historical sense, if we have heard. And this is at the same time his great vice, or at any rate, it is an expression of his fundamental defect, namely his dissatisfaction with himself, with his age, and therefore the urge to escape into the alien and the past, because he is, as they say, alienated. Another description of our virtues is given in the expression, we immoralists. The only aphorism which has an italicized title here is namely 226, has a title, we immoralists. And it appears from that aphorism that immoralism is the reverse side of probity, of intellectual probity. That is a favorite theme of Nietzsche, to show that morality, if it takes itself seriously, leads to the destruction of morality. And since morality taking itself seriously, that means intellectual probity, not behaving immorally towards the principles of morality, by simply accepting them on trust. So contemporary moral teaching, which Nietzsche singles out for special criticism thereafter, is English utilitarianism, which he regards as particularly boring and stupid and narrow. Utilitarianism accepts egoism as a basis of morality, and that is all right with Nietzsche. But it asserts at the same time that egoism, rightly understood, leads to the espousal of the common welfare. In other words, from Nietzsche's point of view, the utilitarians are men who wish to eat the cake and have it, which is always a sign of lacking intellectual profit. While recognizing men's fundamental egoism, the utilitarians do not realize the fact that egoism is will to power and not merely will to live and to live comfortably. And hence, since egoism is will to power, it includes cruelty, for which there is no place in utilitarianism. Think especially of John Stuart Mill, and I always forget the name of his lady, Henriette Taylor, his God's substitute. Well, after he had escaped from the clutches of his father, that Puritan utilitarian, James Mill, he fell into the arms of, I think, Henriette Taylor was her name. And he regarded her as a god. Read his autobiography if you don't believe me. And I'm using historical, I believe. At any rate, there's no place for cruelty there. Cruelty that Nietzsche makes here clear in passing, if turned against oneself, is effective in intellectual probity, in the cruelty of the intellectual conscience, as he calls it here. Now, it is necessary to recognize that cruelty is indispensable if the basic eternal text, Homo Natura, is again to be recognized. We did read that passage at towards the end of number 230, but we should read these few lines again. Will you do that, please? This worthy pomp of words belongs to the old. Do you have that? Well, the last.
To translate man back.
Yeah, no, before.
Before that?
Yeah.
But we hermits and marmots have long persuaded ourselves in the full secrecy of a hermit's conscience that this worthy verbal pomp, too, belongs to the old mendacious pomp, junk and gold dust of unconscious human vanity, and that under such flattering colors and makeup as well, the basic text.
But the terrible text.
The terrible text.
The terrible fundamental text.
The terrible fundamental text of Homo Natura must again be recognized.
Yes.
To translate man back into nature, to become master over many vain and overly enthusiastic interpretations and connotations that have so far been scrawled and painted over that eternal basic text of Homo Natura, to see to it that man henceforth stands before man as even today, hardened in the discipline of science, he stands before the rest of nature with intrepid, vitreous eyes and sealed Odysseus' ears, deaf to the siren songs of old metaphysical bird catchers who have been piping at it all too long. You are more, you are higher, you are of a different origin. That may be a strange and insane task, but it is a task. Who would deny that? Why did we choose this insane task? Or, putting it differently, why have knowledge at all? Everybody will ask us that, and we, pressed this way, we who have put the same question to ourselves 100 times, we have found and find no better answer.
Yeah, but the answer will be given in a way in the next aphorism. And let us first consider this passage which we read. The basic eternal text, Homo Natura, is again to be recognized. Men must be retranslated into nature. One must get rid of the many vain and enthusiastic interpretations which hitherto have concealed that basic text. Now, from this passage, it is not quite clear whether the retranslation of man into nature has been achieved now and then in the past, or whether it is altogether a task for the future, of course, for the philosophers of the future. But I think from other passages in Nietzsche, one can say it has never been achieved in the past. We read in his Will to Power, number 101, there was never yet a natural humanity. Hitherto, humanity, we can say in the language which Nietzsche does not use, was always deflected from naturalness by nomos, by arbitrary and unreasonable laws, without which men would never have been able, finally, to see that basic text. But still, he was not natural hitherto. In the Gay Science, aphorism 109, Nietzsche speaks of the task to, the German word, the verb, vernatürlichen. I don't know how to translate it. To naturalize man would be an approximation, but it is somewhat more to change man, and in a way to deflect man from what he is and from what he always was by making him natural. To do that with man together with a pure, newly found, newly redeemed nature. Now in this work, Beyond Good and Evil, aphorism 62, we have read, man is a not yet fixed brute, so not yet established brute, das noch nicht festgestellte Tier. That fixation is, I believe, the same as what he calls elsewhere the Vernatürlichung, making man natural, for the very good reason, of which we do not yet know whether it is a reason which Nietzsche would recognize, the nature of a being is its end, its completion, completed state, its peak. That is what Aristotle says. And we have, of course, no right to assume that Nietzsche meant the same. Do you have this book here? There is a passage here. Yeah, on page 552, that is in the Twilight of the Islands, in number 48. Read the beginning, please.
Progress in my sense. I too speak of a return to nature.
Listen, that's Vernatürlichung. Yes.
Although it is really not a going back, but an ascent up into the high, free, even terrible nature and naturalness, where great tasks are something one plays with, one may play with. To put it metaphorically, Napoleon was a piece of return to nature,
yes.
As I understand it.
Yes, but only a piece, because he was not a philosopher of the future. But that is. So it is not, strictly speaking, it's not a return to nature, but nature is arrived at for the first time. Man reaches his peak through and in the philosopher of the future as a truly complementary man, in whom not only man, but the rest of existence is justified. Aphorism 207. This complementary man is the first man who consciously creates values on the basis of his understanding of the will to power as a fundamental phenomenon. His action completes the highest form of the most spiritual will to power, and that means the highest form of the will to power, pure and simple. By this action, he puts an end to the rule of nonsense and chance, which was hitherto history, aphorism 203. Now, as an act of the highest form of man's will to power, this naturalization, this vernaturisation of man, is at the same time the peak of the anthropomorphization of non-human nature, of the non-human. For the most spiritual will to power consists in prescribing to nature what or how it ought to be, as we have seen in Aphorism 9. It is in this way that Nietzsche abolishes the distinction between the world of appearance or fiction, or the interpretations, on the one hand, and the true world, the text, on the other. The world of appearance and the true world coincide eventually, in that, owing to that final interpretation, the true interpretation. Now, it was the history of man hitherto, that's to say, the rule of nonsense and chance, which was a necessary condition for the subjugation of nonsense and chance. And I believe that is more or less the accepted opinion today, generally speaking. Evolution, or however you call it, which is not a guided action anyway, has no rhyme and reason, but it so happens that the outcome of it is a being which eventually can reasonably use nonsense chance. This means, if we apply that to Nietzsche's case, to Nietzsche's understanding, the naturalization, vernaturisierung of man, presupposes and brings to its completion the whole historical process. And this completion, which in Nietzsche's, according to Nietzsche, of course, is by no means necessary, but requires a new, free, creative act. Still, in this way, history and the complete historical process can be said to be integrated into nature, because it leads to, it culminates in the vernaturisierung of man. Man is therefore, must therefore say yes, he cannot say yes to the philosophers of the future without saying yes to the past, because that past made possible the project of the philosophers of the future. Yet there is a great difference between this yes to the past and the unbounded yes to everything that was and is. That's to say, the affirmation of eternal return. Why then the eternal return? And on the basis, if we had only beyond good and evil, I believe we would be driven to the following explanation. Instead of explaining why it is necessary to affirm eternal return, Nietzsche indicates that the highest achievement, as all earlier high achievements, is in the last analysis not the work of reason, but of nature. In the last analysis, all thought depends on something unteachable, deep down, that he says in the following aphorism, 231, on a fundamental stupidity, as he does not hesitate to call it. The nature of the individual nature, not evident and universally valid insights, it seems, is the ground of all worthwhile understanding or knowledge. So that seems to be the pure chaos. Yet there is an order of rank of the natures, and at the top of this hierarchy is a complementary man. His supremacy is shown by the fact that he solves the highest and most difficult problem. And we must identify that problem if we want to see Nietzsche's way out of the chaos, of the intellectual chaos. Now, that problem which he solved is posed by the conquest of nature, a conquest which has no assignable limits. Therefore, men can dream, as they began to dream in the 17th century, of the abolition of suffering, including perhaps the abolition of death, and more particularly, the abolition of inequality. All men could become equally supermen in Nietzsche's sense of the term. That would be the true realm of freedom, but that way is excluded because the highest development of man requires suffering, requires inequality. Now, when Nietzsche takes up the question of eternal return for the first time in the Zarathustra, in the section of redemption, he gives some explanation. Perhaps you read it on page 250. Yeah. Read first this paragraph.
When Zarathustra had spoken thus to the hunchback, and to those whose mouthpiece and advocate the hunchback was, he turned to his disciples with profound dismay and said, "Verily, my friends, I walk among men as among the fragments and limbs of men. This is what is terrible for my eyes, that I find man ruined and scattered as over a battlefield or a butcher field. And when my eyes flee from the now to the past, they always find the same, fragments and limbs and dreadful accidents, but no human being."
Is this the whole paragraph? Yeah. So you know that limbs meaning isolated limbs. Say an ear, a leg, so no whole human being. And let us see on the next page, the second paragraph from the top. And you too, yes?
And you too have often asked yourselves, who is Zarathustra to us? What shall we call it? And like myself, you reply to yourselves with questions. Is he a promiser or a fulfiller, a conqueror or an inheritor, an autumn or a plowshare, a physician or one who has recovered? Is he a poet or truthful, a liberator or a
And then another passage, page 253, the second paragraph from the top.
I led you away from these fables when I taught you the will is a creator, and all it was is a fragment, a riddle, a dreadful accident, until the created will says to it, but thus I willed it, until the created will says to it, but thus I will it, thus shall I will it.
That is 810. Now what does it mean? Men are hitherto defective, incomplete, and therefore suffering and inequality, unequal. But these defects and these inequalities are the prerequisites of human greatness. Therefore, the transformation of the human race into a race of supermen would be fatal to human greatness. Hitherto, these defects and inequalities were taken for granted as given or imposed. Now, owing to the man's conquest of nature, they are in danger of being abolished. Therefore, they can no longer be taken for granted as given. Henceforth, they must be willed. Nature owes henceforth its being to human will, to human postulation. Something of this kind had been said by Fichte at the beginning of the 19th or the end of the 18th century. But in Fichte, of course, the willing was the pure ego. And of course, and therefore in no way, that was perfectly outside. But in Nietzsche's case, that's a difficulty. The willing being is the whole individual, Friedrich Nietzsche. That creates a difficulty. The whole man, the individual nature. So I believe then that the primary motive of, and the most intelligible motive of the doctrine of eternal return is in Nietzsche is to make intelligible nature as humanly willed and not given. And the whole difficulty of Nietzsche's philosophy, I believe, is concentrated in this point. Yes?
I have a question about Nietzsche's judgment concerning a certain point.
Yes.
He spoke before about the idea of naturalizing man, which seems to mean, to me, as I can see, it means putting man in harmony with nature. In some way, that would be...
In making him nature natural.
Yeah, in making him natural, but that might mean destroying his particular nature, which is to have a nomos.
No. Then, if nomos is understood in contradistinction to nature, then the nomos must be abandoned.
But yeah, that's the way I see it. So then the next thing that we talked about was the idea of preserving the hierarchy. The distinction between those who are more somehow elevated and those that are lower. And it seems to me that the mistake in Nietzsche's judgment is to think that as the nomos is abandoned, the hierarchy will be preserved. I mean, I'm even thinking about something as temporal as 20th century America, where the nomos is being abandoned. And rather than having
no, it's not abandoned. It's only replacement of one.
Well,
I mean, they're long hair instead of short hair. And what's the other characteristics of that subculture are?
Well,
and say marijuana instead of husband or whatever.
Yeah. I think that I would, when I said America today, I was thinking that the subculture represents not another nomos, but anti-nomos.
Yeah, but that is, you cannot. They are not such awe-inspiring people that we have to accept their own view of themselves as, that we have to accept it as authoritative. And it is rather obvious that while they oppose prevailing nomos, they replace it by another nomos. If they said in former times, in the 40s, I don't remember if they heard that, in America, everyone can do what he wants. Everyone can pursue happiness in his own fashion. But every Sunday, you see all of authority going, using a certain type of car to go to a certain kind of places, to eat a certain kind of dinner, and so on and so on. So, why? You have the extreme individualism as principle. In practice, we have an amazing conformity. Now, this is how Europeans looked at it. But I think if I can still imagine how a European thinks, would see the younger generation of America's subculture, he would say they are exactly the children of their parents. They have conformism, a new conformism.
I guess what I'm trying to say is the new conformism seems to be a conformism of complete equality. And to the extent that it's a break with the former nomos, and it claims to be a break with nomos simply.
It claims.
It seems to me, though, that possibly Nietzsche is mistaken about this. Possibly the removal of the nomos does not provide for the possibility of a real hierarchy, but it provides for the possibility only of a complete equality and complete uniformity.
Yeah, well, that Nietzsche was not unaware of this possibility. It becomes most clear from the speech on the last man near the beginning of the Zarathustra. He saw that it could be a possibility, you know. There is no hierarchy anymore, that, and no striving, no longing anymore. There is no... you have read that speech.
Yes, I have.
Well, that is a point, surely.
That seems to be a good hedge.
Yeah, but it should be minor changes, because these people say, as if I remember well, if someone thinks differently, he goes voluntarily into the insane asylum. Today you would have to say he goes just to the psychoanalyst. It doesn't have to be institutionalized. But some other minor changes would have to be made. But he has seen that possibility very clearly. And nevertheless, I think it is a nomos, because the very extirpation, the intended extirpation of the natural differences, of the natural hierarchy, is an attack on nature, and not merely, and therefore an act of the nomos. And there was a criticism of this written millennia ago, but it is usually not considered. And that is in Aristophanes' Assembly of Women, where they try to establish a fully egalitarian society. and the women do well. And for this purpose, the women must rule. So this kind of inequality of the two sexes must prevail, just as the women's lib movement would also lead in practice to rule of to gynecocracy, not to equality. All right, and then we have this beautiful situation. And everyone is equal, and the women are the mothers who feed their children, the males. And a part of this feeding is, of course, also sexual gratification. And here there comes in the difference between women who are attractive and women who are not attractive, a natural inequality. Therefore, the legislator has to make a special law in order to equalize that inequality, so that, if I may be so crude, but since Aristophanes has done it before me, I have some excuse. A young man cannot sleep with a young girl before he has slept with an ugly one. So you see, there is a privilege given to the inferior to equalize nature. That's the problem. I mean, and it's as far from its solution today as it was in the past, but you have only to replace the somewhat unseemly Aristophanian example by a more elevated one, and then you have a statement of all. Yeah. Good. I'm sorry.
I have a question. I can understand why one, in the future, one might have to say yay everything that has happened and indeed will happen. But doesn't the doctrine of eternal return state something even more that I don't understand the reason for, namely that everything will recur?
Yeah.
And that seems to be an extra fact that Nietzsche brings in, and I see no reason for it. That he just happened to believe that? Or?
No, but I think the point is, if you make the experiment and say, oh, I will, you cannot leave it by merely willing it. You must assert it. You must wish it.
But I don't have, you mean to wish, to wish it is not simply to wish it, but its eternal return.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
I don't see the logic of that.
If it is to be nature, if it is, if this hierarchy of which Nietzsche thinks in the first place is natural, and if man is not to be, and his whole history is not to be merely to be an accident, a few seconds, and millions of and billions of years before without man, and billions of years afterward, there must be eternity of the human race. Now, in the literal sense, it is impossible because Nietzsche, quote, knew, unquote, that the visible universe will perish, and therefore the Aristotle's solution is out of the question.
I thought he described some mathematical notion that
That is a consequence on it. But he knew that, therefore, for him, what was possible for him was only what we may call, in historical terms, the Lucretian solution. This visible universe to which we belong will perish, but another visible universe will come again, or may already be there, a place with which we have no contact by astronauts or otherwise, you know? So that is, I think there is only the Aristotelian and the Lucretian way out, if you want to preserve the sempiternity of the human race, either a strict sempiternity, a continuous sempiternity, Aristotle, or a discontinuous one, conclusions.
Yes, I was under the impression that Nietzsche subscribed to some third one, in which, if you will, in infinite time, the same configurations must recur.
Yeah, that is one of the arguments which he uses in order to support it. But the fundamental thesis is not bound up with it. In other words, let me put it this way, the eternal return could mean eternal return of the human race in general. It could also mean eternal return of you, of each individual, with his particular life fate and other. And Nietzsche selected the latter on grounds which have nothing to do with what I said today, namely, as he called it, as a substitute for the belief in immortality of the soul, to give the individual the highest sense of responsibility for his action, that a man must say to himself, whatever I do now, I will have to repeat infinitely often. And it's true that it's an important point for Nietzsche, but that is not brought up here, and perhaps this is one of the reasons why Beyond Good and Evil is more attractive for me than some other writing. Yes? I did not understand you acoustically completely. Why?
You were about to say that the problem when Nietzsche philosophy lies in his saying that man has to will nature.
Yes, because let us take this crucial example, the hierarchy, what he calls order of rank, the hierarchy, which was always regarded as a fact. And well, you know it from the discussions in the daily papers, where people said, you know, speak of IQs, higher and lower ones, and then today we hear that's all nonsense. And I mean, apart from all other reasons, because these IQs are of conventional origin. By nature, all men would have the same IQ. But some have poor home, home background, and others have a better high home background. And if you extend it and to the genes, well, the genes can also be influenced. You know, that is the rule of nonsense and unreason hitherto. That is not natural in any awe-inspiring sense. So that is indeed superficially given, but radically questioned. But if for one reason or the other, be it for reasons of mere prejudice, someone wants to preserve the natural inequality, he must first have willed nature. It is not simply given. The conquest of nature, whether technologically or theoretically, has made this appeal to nature, the tradition, appeal to nature of which we may constitute we ourselves, question. And Nietzsche's way out, a very problematical way out, is to make it a postulation of the will. I do not know whether I made it somewhat clearer to you.
I have so many questions in my head.
I beg your pardon.
I have so many questions now in my head.
What about the niches about death? With the will of conquer death and environmental resolve, is that not bad?
no. Death must be.
No?
Death must be.
Must be. Why?
Because man could not be reach his high stature without dying.
But it is not true. What we should be natural, man is always not true.
Yes.
And returning to this eternal return, always to be this unfinished nature of man?
For most men, yes. If these cripples and fragments, as he calls them.
Well, if one can be immortal, everyone.
No. I mean, immortality is out. It's absolutely. And if, I believe, he as a reason he would give you, perhaps, but what Swift gives as a reason in the third part of Gulliver's Travel, because there would be age, the immortals there, I forgot the name there, figure it out how it would be if he were immortal. In the body and the soul, that is out of the question for other reason, that a disembodied soul would survive.
But now, the nature of man is before being. The nature of man is before being. Now, the nature of man is becoming.
All right. That is a formula which Nietzsche accepts. That is a formula which Nietzsche would accept. No, he would say becoming, but there is the highest approximation of becoming to being is exactly eternal return. Namely, their becoming, the change, is eternal, is always, therefore, is.
So, his becoming is eternal,
would be being, eternal.
Yeah, all
right. Being. Yes.
And the becoming would be this power, will, to
to an activation of what you do, to creation of what you do through the will to power. Yeah. It seems that when you think about Nietzsche's doctrine of the eternal return, the only way to appreciate it is to think of Nietzsche as some kind of poet, not as a serious investigator of the way things are or the way things are ever likely to be. This seems to be a mythical doctrine which is stated, as you say, partly for the sake of making men feel a certain responsibility for the things that they do. But even if it were taken as a useful story, a likely story, or maybe an unlikely story that is invented by this poetical man, it seems to fall apart because a man can say, well, the things that I'm doing now, I've already done many times over, and there's not much that I can do that's going to affect what I'm going to do in the future.
You one doesn't understand it as Nietzsche wants to be understood. Because the will, you presuppose you know that you will always return, and then you act on that. But here, the knowledge follows the will.
But that means that it has to be understood as a kind of poetry. It has to be understood as a kind of lyrical poetry in which a man has a certain inspiration. He sees the will to power as the highest force in the universe, the highest truth. And from that, he generates all kinds of things which he considers to be
good consequences that would be consistent with the idea of the will to power, no matter how ridiculous they are. Even the idea that a person's individual life is going to be eternally repeated, no matter how ridiculous.
Let me say only one more thing on this subject. You apparently have completely forgotten or have been completely unimpressed by what Nietzsche says about the problem of science. You said there a serious investigation of what the term you used and contrasted that with poetry. All right. But the very notion of serious investigation which you used has been questioned by Nietzsche, especially in the first chapter. In fact, throughout.
Sure.
And perhaps he has some reasons. Perhaps you see there is no, in the 19th century they used the expression, especially in Germany, but I believe also in other countries, presuppositionless science. Did you ever hear that?
I've always understood that as being an objective science.
Yeah, but at that time they used that expression, presuppositionless science. And that was exploded, not only by Nietzsche, but I think by Nietzsche with special vigor. And if that is so, if science is as much based on questionable, quote, poetic assumptions as poetry in your sense, one cannot well apply the distinction. And let us just read Aphorism 231.
Learning changes us. It does what all nourishment does.